everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2019, and you're listening to episode 135, and it's a literary apologetics discussion about the novelist Cormac McCarthy and his novel, The Road. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Mitchell. Stephen teaches English at Covenant Day School in North Carolina and has a PhD in humanities from Faulkner University. Stephen has written an online exclusive literary apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Questing for Divine Love, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and it's free online at equip.org. Stephen, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be here.
Well, I don't know if our listeners are familiar with the work of Cormac McCarthy, but they might be familiar with some movie versions of his work that have won some Oscar awards. And so some of those are like No Country for Old Men. And also The Road was made into a film, but it wasn't as acclaimed as No Country for Old Men that won some Oscars. So he did win the Pulitzer Prize for this book in 2007, so more than a decade ago. So we're going to be discussing the book. There's going to be all kinds of spoilers, but maybe it'll inspire our listeners to read the book. Because when I read the book, I don't know if I read it back then, it was close to when it won the Pulitzer Prize. It was such an affecting work. I highly recommend everyone read this book. In fact, it was very haunting. It stayed with me for a couple of weeks. I couldn't get it out of my mind, really. And it was just such a brilliant idea of how to take all the distractions away from life in its setting and then just really consider some very deep philosophical questions. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about who he is and what makes his work compelling.
Sure. So, contemporary novelist. I think he's close to 85 now, so not sure how much longer he'll be with us, but he's still writing. His works are often marked by quite a lot of violence. Blood Meridian is certainly so. No Country for Old Men is quite so. The Road, of course, very, very violent, very stark. But McCarthy is, I think, in his own estimation, at least, he's getting down to kind of the grit of human existence, life and death. I think it was in an interview maybe with Oprah Winfrey where he said that to him that was the mark of real literature, that it deals with life and death. And McCarthy especially dealing with the kind of extremes that people go to, will go to, under pressure or just from sheer wickedness. Blood Meridian is, for example, certainly an examination of some of the violent undertones and tendencies of American history. No Country for Old Men, though it has been decades since I've read that book, is certainly looking at its simplest level, just the power of greed. And the kind of violence we will risk just to, you know, keep our hands upon things that we think will bring us security. So I think that Cormac McCarthy would see his writing as being elemental in that sense. You mentioned The Road being stripped down, and I think there's a sense in which much of his work is that way, stripped down. And so it makes you ask about the nature of human beings, what kind of creatures we are, and why we can so often do such violent and horrific things. And that, I think, is what makes him compelling as a writer. Of course, he is just excellent at evoking scene and setting, and really at appalling his readers with a violence that is, on the one hand, extreme, and on the other hand, thoroughly believable. And that's perhaps what makes his work a kind of disturbing that stays with you, because the humans in his books, they come across as real, even though they're doing often extreme things, as doing the kinds of things that we might indeed find ourselves doing. And that can be personally disturbing. since most of us at least like to consider ourselves civilized and with a veneer, if nothing else, of genteelness, I think, in the sense of not being savages. But McCarthy gets at a savageness that does show itself in human life, and does so, perhaps paradoxically, with real beauty in his novels. So I think that's part, I mean, there's probably a host of other things, but part of what makes his work compelling just by itself as literature.
So for the Christian apologist, what makes Cormac McCarthy's work, you know, of interest? Why should they read his work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So any author, I think, of the stature and skill of someone like McCarthy, who says forthrightly that his concern is with life and death, is going to push his readers toward or evoke in his readers questions about ultimate things. You know, death, again, is sort of, it's either the final thing altogether, or it's certainly the boundary of existence in this world. And because it's a boundary, it begets inevitable questions about, you know, what, if anything, is next, or what, if anything, transcends this physical realm that we inhabit and that we know about. So questions about, you know, in the road especially, about whether or not there is a God, and if there is a God, whether he is in any sense interested in us, looking out for us, attending to us. Questions about just human nature. As I referenced earlier, Cormac McCarthy's characters tend to be quite violent, or to find themselves acting violently, though that's not, you know, the only thing necessarily that's true about them. But his novels make us, I think, grapple with how much power and nihilism and violence are kind of hidden, perhaps, under the surface of the society we inhabit, and whether or not there is something true besides the desire for power. Is that it? Or is there a bedrock truth, a bedrock goodness to being that we need to know about? And this isn't necessarily because I'm thinking specifically at the moment of Blood Meridian, because I think the text reveals that, but that there is such a bedrock being, but in some ways because the characters, the lead character, the judge, is so nihilistic, and the novel ends in such a kind of triumph of nihilism that it pushes us to find some alternative to that, or to want to find some alternative to that. And so there is a point where the Christian apologist may have some real interest in Cormac McCarthy, in having to grapple with the implications of a nihilistic vision of the world.
When we think about the road, the setting is, you know, post-apocalyptic, dystopian kind of genre. And there's so much of that out there in film and books. But this one was extremely different to me. It was very different. It was more affecting, as I said earlier. It was more stripped down. It was more visceral. And I feel like I've read a lot in this genre. So can you kind of just lay out the basic plot of the novel for us?
Yeah, visceral and more affecting. I think one of the things that sometimes gets a little bit disappointing sometimes about post-apocalyptic dramas is that sometimes you get the sense that they're just sort of reveling in a kind of, let's see what sort of violence we can imagine just for the heck of it. And this one, it seems thought out in terms of what that existence would actually be like. And so for the basic plot, the world has suffered a nuclear holocaust. We're not told how or why. I mean, how is bombs, but we don't know any of the situation prior to the holocaust that decimates, so far as the character, known only as the man, and his son, known only as the boy, so far as they know, a holocaust that has engulfed the planet. Of course, this not knowing is part of what they struggle with, but the story opens sort of mid-journey, and you just have this basic sense that the man is trying to get the boy to somewhere vaguely east and south of where they are, and they are somewhere generally in the Appalachian Mountains, where the hope is it's warmer, and maybe there are people that they can safely join themselves to. So they're on this journey through a world that is dead. I mean, just completely dead. Nothing is alive in terms of plant life. There's maybe one hint of a stray dog through the whole piece, but animals are all dead. And, you know, the world is in a nuclear winter, as they call it, because so much ash has infected the sky that the sun's heat cannot really penetrate and warm the earth. So they are on this journey, just trying to find enough food and warmth to stay alive and avoiding these marauding bands of what are essentially cannibals, because most of the humans left are those who are cannibals. They're willing to eat other people. And in fact, they actively seek out other human beings to eat. And part of the irony, part of the deep and disturbing evil that is revealed here is that these people are still alive in part for this very reason, that they're willing to eat other people. In other words, that's the most available food source, and they're willing to avail themselves of it. And as they make this journey, they just come upon scene after violent scene of the destruction that the Holocaust itself visited upon the earth, where they will find melted bodies in the asphalt, or the kind of ensuing violence with these marauding gangs, where they will find skeletons of humans who have been essentially eaten, stripped of their flesh, killed and eaten, and nothing left but either, you know, a pile of bones or a pile of guts. So it's very dark. And the man is trying to get his son, this young boy who's, it's not quite clear how old he is, that's left vague, but probably 10 years or younger. And he's trying to protect him biologically, you know, keep him alive, but also spiritually trying to nurture something in him and get him to a place of safety before he dies, because the man himself is quite ill, probably from ingesting the ash that is, you know, so heavily polluting the air. So, you know, that's it. It's just almost scene after scene after scene of a kind of near-death struggle to survive. And then the question that arises out of that, what kind of man is he? And what kind of boy is this boy? Are they themselves going to be overrun by the nihilism of the world? Or is there something real, something divine, something moral at the center of humanity that they can hold on to, that they can nurture? That is the basic plot of The Road.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Stephen Mitchell, and we are having a conversation about his book review of Cormac McCarthy's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Road. And his review is available free online at our website, equip.org. And I want to invite you to partner with us to continue providing all this great equipping free online content. And this content is in the form of this podcast, Postmodern Realities, as well as all of our exclusive online feature articles, book reviews, film and television series reviews. You can do so by partnering with us in two different ways. One is with a print subscription to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50 for our quarterly magazine, and you can subscribe at our website, equip.org. And another way that's new on our website that you can support this podcast and our journal and all of the outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, including our flagship Bible Answer Man broadcast with CRI President Hank Canagraff and his podcast, Hank Unplugged, is you can now tip us when you read our articles or listen to our podcast. So at the link for this episode on our website, you can tip us. And so how you get there is you go to equip.org, you click magazine, at the drop-down menu, click PMR podcast. Then you can easily find the landing page for this conversation about Cormac McCarthy's The Road. And there's a link there where you could give us a tip of, say, $3 or $5, which basically is the equivalent of some people's favorite drink, like a coffee latte, their favorite coffee drink. And you can also either subscribe at that link and think about if you give us a small tip. Now, you might already subscribe, so you can also give us a tip there to, as your way of continuing to partner with us, or maybe a subscription is not in your budget right now. So that's easy. Can't afford $33.50 in your budget? Please consider giving us $3, which is less than a popcorn at your local movie theater. And just think of all this equipping information that you get to help you to think and live Christianly. So we are really grateful for all of our print subscribers and for each one of you that listens to our material, our podcasts, and reads our articles. I just want you to know that we do not take your support for granted, and we are grateful for you. So I would just like to encourage you to think about giving us a tip. And thank you. We were just talking about the basic plot of The Road, and I think one thing that struck me when I read the book so long ago was the fact that it's when it drops you into this post-apocalyptic wasteland, and as the story progresses, you just are drained of any hope. I mean, you start thinking about what is meaningful in life. What if everything was stripped bare? In other words, there was nothing left. There was no commerce. There were no, and to me anyway, he was making a point about how shallow some of our pursuits are, materialist pursuits, as they go into these grandiose old homes that were probably once mansions, and they're just covered with this nuclear gray ash. And so you're just slowly drained of any hope for these people as they encounter just, you know, wretched individuals that you mentioned before, who are pursuing cannibalism, and the dads and the fathers, you know, trying to in some manner shield his son. And I agree with you. I imagined in my mind, he's not really young, but he's not yet a teenager, maybe more 10 or 11 years old. So what are some of the challenges for the Christian, to the Christian faith, that arise from reading this novel?
Well, I would say there is this question about what's at the bedrock of our existence. And you talk about these houses that used to be grand, and these are places that they go to find shelter, sometimes successfully in the sense that there's nobody else inhabiting the house, and so they can stay warm for a little while. And sometimes, to their great terror, discovering that the place is in fact inhabited by cannibals themselves, who are trapping human beings and eating them, harvesting their body parts while they live. And so you have to ask, I suppose, you know, in terms of the shallowness of our pursuits, I think the question that McCarthy asks is there anything really good and virtuous in the world that we have built, or is it really sort of underneath the skin of that grandness? Is it just violence and greed and rapine and a greed for power that's just sort of laid bare by this nuclear holocaust? Or is there something else in human beings? Is there a moral center in us that is real and has some hope of triumphing, some hope of rising above an otherwise deep human propensity for violence? But another thing that arises from this is that in a way that's different from, say, earlier books we've written about and discussed, you know, the problem of evil is kind of a big philosophical problem in the 19th and 20th centuries. But McCarthy's approach isn't so much the philosophical problem of evil as it is the psychological problem of evil. That if you did experience such a thing, and it's a realistic possibility, our world has, you know, vast nuclear arsenals, and we could put much of the planet, I suppose, I don't know for sure if it could be all of the planet, but we could put much of the planet into a nuclear winter. And in suffering such violence, you know, if humans can do this, then what does it mean to say that they bear the image of God? So that becomes a problem of faith that arises here. Second, it becomes hard psychologically to believe in God, or can become difficult, not because you've done some sort of philosophical reasoning about, you know, some sort of tension between divine goodness and evil, but just because every action says that you and your life don't matter. And if they don't matter to other people, it's hard to believe that they matter to God. Goodness, in any sort of fundamental ontological sense, that existence is good because it's a gift of a divine being, is deeply troubled by such an event. And the actions of the other human beings who want to use each other and the man and his son as food, to say that you are nothing more than food for those who are more powerful than you or who can get the better of you. If that approach is sort of worldwide, if that's all you're seeing, all you're experiencing, if the religious structures and the legal structures that have helped to teach you a moral code and a spiritual reality and a way to live, if all of those have been destroyed, you know, what would it mean to keep believing in God in this situation? And so that stripped down to an existence that looks like it's just bare survival then calls us to question, where is God in this, if he is in this? And what in the world is wrong with human beings? And so the book pushes us toward those sorts of questions, just making faith psychologically difficult in a setting such as The Road creates for us.
It seems that Cormac McCarthy has, when he writes in what is happening to the father and the boy, they're like these things happen to them that are really almost grandiose acts of evil to them. I mean, it's an onslaught. It's like, do you hope that there is some kind of respite from it? But it's from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. They may just barely miss something all the way up until the very final. I don't want to give a big spoiler. One of the last scenes of the book where there's these unspeakable horrors happening to an infant. And you're just wondering, is there any value? The man is trying to keep his son alive because he loves him. And yet, is there any value to human life? By the end of the book, you're almost feeling this emotional spentness from it. So how does that continue to challenge, you know, specifically, I would think, for Christians, Christian faith? And how would you talk to a non-Christian, a non-religious person reading this book? And how would that make kind of the nihilism that he presents attractive? I mean, definitely you're left with, and I was thinking about it, like I said at the beginning, for a couple of weeks, with just like, what is there any meaning to life in life? If something like that happened, where would there be meaning found at all?
Yeah, and that's really well said. And this is what I think McCarthy is so good at doing, is making us ask, is there real meaning to life at its bedrock roots? And I think the honest answer to that question is that in the face of such an event, a worldwide nuclear holocaust, I think that would like legitimately cause most people to stumble in any sense of retaining faith. I'm not saying it logically goes out the window, and I'm not saying everybody would fold, but if all you can do is just stay alive, why do you keep going on doing it? And this question is not just part of the boy and the man, like why do they keep going? But it's also a question, honestly, of the marauding cannibal groups, because, you know, their lives are certainly not in any sense pleasant. All that anyone is doing is eking out survival. So then the question is, as you said, why? 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 And, you know, you'd ask, why would you want to keep your son alive in this situation? And of course, the man's wife, this is a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's necessary. The man's wife does commit suicide. She determines that there is no point in going on, that the only thing they have waiting for them is to be captured. Of course, there's, in addition to the cannibalism, there's a lot of sexual violence. So she feels they'll be raped and then they'll be eaten. And she is just not willing to risk that kind of an end. And so she eventually takes her own life and abandons the boy and the man in so doing. And that is, I think, the part where McCarthy is just trying to sort of truthfully render the effects of an event like this, or the effects of intensive evil. Because, of course, a nuclear holocaust isn't the only possibility. People suffer grand acts of evil kind of just to their own persons. And what those acts of evil, I think, do is they communicate. They say to that person, you don't matter. Your life has no meaning. You are whatever I, the more powerful aggressor in this situation, decides to make of you. And on the one hand, I suppose her suicide could be seen as an act of defiance, but it is, in a sense, also, it acquiesces to that, because it says that what is going to triumph in this world is cannibalism and rape and murder. Like, those are the supreme values, if you will call them that, of this world. The man, on the other hand, says, and to me, the most beautiful line in the book, it's early in the book, and this is going to sound grandiloquent, but maybe in all of contemporary literature, he looks at the boy and he says, if he is not a word of God, God never spoke. And so this man, he sees this boy as a good gift in the midst of this horrific destruction of life. The boy is born brief, just very soon after the nuclear holocaust descends upon the world. And I think he takes the boy as the hope of something new, as a hope of renewal. But he isn't sure. Like, that's the problem, because, of course, protecting, keeping that boy alive, keeping himself alive to protect that boy, and trying to show his son that there is a possibility of something better is so nearly impossible. So he simply continually talks to him about the need, he'll use the imagery of the fire, to keep the fire alive inside of them. And he seems to mean by that the boy's conscience, his moral sense, his sense that there is a right and a wrong, a good and a bad, and that he is responsible to choose the good and to resist the evil. But also it's a light of hope. I think the two are linked here. That there is good to be found, right? But that's the difficulty. That's the contrast. Because as you pointed out, the whole time you're saying, where is it? Like, where is the good? Where is the hope to be found? If existence is just avoiding one kind of vile, dehumanizing form of death after another. So it challenges this idea that we are watched over by a God who loves us. Not by taking the question up in depth, but by creating a world in which you have to ask that question, like, where is he? Where is God in all of this? Where is any restoration that would make living in this world worthwhile? And yet, if there is an answer to it, it is in the relationship between that man and his son. It is in the fact that, contrary to what seems most reasonable, he loves his son. And he wants his son to live. Like, this is just sort of an axiomatic bedrock thing. You can't get beneath it. Either it's worthwhile to be alive or it's not. And you can't really argue it so much as recognize that your son is a gift. And therefore, you know, from there, you could reason that your life is a gift and so on and so forth from there. But the nihilism becomes attractive in maybe two ways. First of all, it's a way to escape. I don't have to endure this horror if really there is no meaning to life. So I can say no to it and I can take my exit. And that's what his wife does. And it's a move that is hard not to be sympathetic with. On the other hand, some, I think Eric Weilenberg, have seen it as a kind of stark leveling of all false values, to be able to rebuild somewhere where humanity can flourish. Now, Weilenberg is, you know, not a believer. He's an atheist. But he sort of sees the love between the boy and a man as this kind of choice that humans can make, this ability to create values, I suppose, where they don't really exist, that all values are wholly human in their origin, and somewhat like Camus in this. So, like, for him, the nihilism is a leveling that makes starting again possible. I think he's wrong about that, but those are the two ways I think that the nihilism can become attractive. And I don't think that Cormac McCarthy makes terribly clear, as far as the story itself goes, which of the two possibilities is necessarily the better choice. And I think that there's an intentional ambiguity there in the way he constructs the novel.
I want to go back a little bit. You were mentioning a few moments ago about how the man has seen the boy almost... his son almost has a sense, sign of renewal, some kind of hopefulness, especially in their relationship. And so how does the character of the boy become more of a focus of hope, a locus of hope, more of like someone that the reader can see that even in how he responds to his dad, that there is something hopeful about him and in their relationship and how he is trusting in his dad and following him places. And there's just something more to, there's a deepness to their relationship.
There is. And that's what saves the novel from being just a story of desolation. So, you know, if you think about how this man probably sees things, you know, a worldwide nuclear holocaust that wipes out civilizations all over the world is pretty much an unquestionable triumph of human hate, right? Of seeing the other as no longer worthy of existence. And of course, you know, one's enemies seeing, you know, oneself that way also, in this kind of reciprocal hatred that just eliminates everything, destroys life. And as a kind of culmination of a way of relating one person to another, one's nation to another, that ends up in the destruction of everybody. But after that destruction happens, this boy is born. And I think for the man, he's somehow severed from that other world, or he wants him to be, right? The world that culminated in a global nuclear holocaust, this boy came into existence after that, came into the world after that. So he has to train him to live a different kind of life. And it is interesting that the one, you know, McCarthy only refers to the man as the man and the boy as the boy. And almost everything in the novel is nameless, except that the boy calls his father Papa, this term of intimacy, this term of closeness, it suggests that the relationship which exists between them is not one of power and greed and domination. It's love. It's mutual love and self-sacrificing love. This man is willing to sacrifice his life to give his son a chance to live. And of course, this is a different thing, a different way of relating to another person than a Holocaust would suggest, because a Holocaust would suggest, I will destroy you so that I can exist, or because I feel you as a threat to my existence. And of course, that ends up destroying everybody, but it's a different way of relating, as is the way that the cannibal bands are put together, right? They relate based on power, right? I will eat you, I will destroy you so that I can stay alive. And even within those cannibal bands, you know, basically everybody else becomes eventually food for everyone else. So the fact that there is something between these two that transcends mere survival, that finding food and finding shelter, and even, and this gets complicated when the man is himself violent, because he does take life. But when he does that, it is in an attempt to protect his son's biological and spiritual and moral well-being. It's the fact that this boy can have love, can love his father, and this man can have love in a world that says, or in a situation that says, love is stupid. I mean, I might go that far. Love has no traction. Nothing is worth loving. And the fact that the boy can remain compassionate, this is sort of what's extraordinary about him, is that he wants to help the handful of other survivors that they meet along the road. He wants to give of their meager resources. So the fact that in him there is this light, his father teaches him that they are carriers of the light. And then he sometimes has to remind his father, so his father doesn't, on a microcosmic level, recapitulate that violent tendency which decimated the world, doesn't recapitulate that toward the people they meet and kill them out of fear for his son's life. He continually has to guard the light and chooses to guard this light that is in him, this sense that we, you know, it's pretty stripped down. We don't eat people, and that's what makes us the good guys. And insofar as we are able, we share what we have with others rather than trying to hoard it for ourselves. And so the fact that he's like that, and that there is this love, this deep loving bond between these two, provides that dim but persistent source of light in the story, in an otherwise utterly dark novel. But it is also a hope that remains tenuous, as we'll probably get into in the next several questions.
Well, you mentioned this idea of them you know, carrying the light. You know, his dad is telling his son that we are the good guys. You know, we have the fire. We're good. And so there's this kind of ambiguous nature of hope that we've kind of talked about a little bit in the novel. So how does this imagery of light and carrying the fire and so forth support this idea of just kind of what we're talking about, a hope, just not really knowing if there's completely, if there's hope? There's just kind of the ambiguousness of it that he gives, which is really evident to the reader. I mean, even if you're a person of faith, you just have that sense of it.
Yeah, you do. And I think the kind of story that it is, I think that that almost has to be the case to take seriously the power of human evil, like what evil is capable of. You would have to make the hope ambiguous, even, like you said, even if you were a person of faith. So this, you know, light is part of the story, oddly enough, almost more by its absence, because of course the sun is almost entirely obscured. So they get some grayish dawns and the nights are absolutely black because of course there's no starlight, there's no moonlight. Nothing gets through the ash at night. And the only thing that allows them to survive the bitter cold that obviously has descended on the planet because of this is the fires, the literal fires that they sit around at night and manage to stay warm enough to stay alive. It's usually not much beyond that. And so, you know, with the sun being gone and its ability to warm the earth and give life, renew animal life, renew plant life, give humans the warmth they need, there is the loss of all of that. And of course, in Western literature and well beyond Western literature as well, obviously, the sun has often functioned as a symbol of the kind of light by which we navigate not just the physical world, but our moral world as well and our spiritual world. It can be an image of truth and meaning. And so it's being obscured by this nuclear holocaust plays into this question about whether there is anything true or good or meaningful to our existence. But then there is this counter light, right? And it's only metaphorical, but it's the light inside. There's this other fire, not just the physical fire around which they huddle at night, but there's the fire that they carry in their hearts. And it is both a source of warmth and a source of illumination. But it's troublesome because it doesn't have any sure ground. I mean, you know, the man, he can't really point to anything. He can't point to any human act, really, you know, any historical act, because that world is gone. He can't point to ancestors. He can't point to anybody living around him and saying, hey, there's an example of how you should live, because everything around him is murder and death and brutality. There's a line in the book where it says that he helped to nurture the fire with old stories of courage and justice. And so he does have some connection to this kind of narrative of virtue. But of course, the boy has nothing really to connect that to. And so he then sees his father encounter here and there other stragglers. And his father sometimes seems to the boy to act contrary to what he's teaching the boy. He doesn't want to share their food with this starving man. And he wants to kill unnecessarily a man who stole some of their supplies. And so the boy has to continually remind him also that, you know, we're the good guys. That's kind of what's funny. Like, the father teaches him we're the good guys. The boy asks again and reminds his own father, we're the good guys. So the question then becomes, like, how do you nurture this light? And it's only by the fact that they remind each other again and again, back and forth, we're the good guys, we're the good guys. And as a kind of sort of fundamental bedrock axiom, a starting point for moral heat, if you will, spiritual light, moral light, is just, we don't eat people. Like, that's a pretty stark line, but we don't eat people. But of course, if they don't survive, that light goes out. And that's part of why it remains ambiguous, because it's not clear that they're going to survive. Even at the end, and I'll try not to give too much of a spoiler, but, well, the man, when he dies and finds another family to pass the boy on to, that is an extraordinary moment of hope in the novel. But this family is struggling to survive. They're in the same straitened circumstances this man was with his son, and it's not clear that they're going to hold out. So it remains there as a possibility. And I don't think McCarthy makes it any more certain than that, that human moral good might survive and it might not. It might renew the world and it might not. There is, of course, one other sort of image that I think has to be brought into this. And that is, there's a moment in the novel where he says that the sun circled the planet obscured by the mist, and it relates it to like a grieving mother with a lamp. And there's times when the light is associated with the divine or with God in this novel. The boy's called God's own fire drake and other things. So the light in him is possibly a kind of window to God as well.
There's almost a curious theme of hospitality in the novel, in that when we associate hospitality, we think of abundance and a sense of lushness and a sense of sharing out of an abundance because there's more than we can even consume ourselves, right? And so it's interesting that there's glimpses of hospitality both in an almost a diabolical evil way when they come upon this house with this elderly couple, and then they realize they're not all they seem to be. And yet the idea of the boy himself, even just in his young age, having this notion that he has to share. They're barely making it, but if they come along, they do come into some food in the novel, and kind of like in one of those doomsday prepper, you know, bunkers type of thing, they stumble upon this food, and later on there's somebody else that's an older man, and the boy wants to share the food. And I don't know if that's like his childlike innocence or this idea that he is someone bringing hope in the novel.
Yeah. Yeah. So hospitality and hope there, it gets sort of to this idea of whether or not existence, by that I mean our being in the world or the being of the world, is a gift from an infinite divine source, or whether it's a thing that we secure for ourselves. And hospitality, at least the Christian virtue of hospitality, is rooted, yes, in the notion of abundance, but less in the fact that I know that I personally possess enough to survive and share, and more in the sense that the source of what I have is ultimately God, and He is infinite, and He is infinitely fruitful and infinitely generous. And so I give out of a recognition of that. The contrary to that, obviously, is I secure as much for myself as I can, and I guard it. I guard it vigorously from you who are a threat to my having enough. And I would argue that McCarthy intends us to see the nuclear holocaust, which has created the setting for this novel, as kind of, on a grand worldwide scale, a violation of the virtue of hospitality, an attempt by one group or another to eliminate those they see as competitors for what they need in order to survive and flourish. And so if that's what brought us to this pass, to this situation, then it's reasonable at least to consider that the only way to renew that, right, is to reintroduce hospitality as a virtue. But that only makes sense, I think, if there is indeed a divine source of everything that is kind of the guarantee of abundance, and that there is enough to share. So they're in these straitened circumstances, right? They do have a limited supply, but the boy is always willing to share it. Not because he's done the sort of philosophical reasoning, but because he simply recognizes that these others also need this sustenance to stay alive, and he's not so protective of himself and his own interests as to deny another human being what he needs. But hospitality also can create its own problems, at least in a world where violence is possible, in that if I am being hospitable to somebody and I welcome them into my house, then if somebody else assaults them, I tend to want to protect them. And this is, I think, where hospitality of the man gets difficult, because he's welcoming to his son, but by being welcoming to his son, he gets very close to being unnecessarily violent to other people. And to, again, recreating on a smaller scale the same way of living that climaxed in the nuclear Holocaust that they're suffering from. And of course, the one scene that's probably worse than any other for this is when they go to this house, we've alluded to it a couple times, hoping to have a place of refuge for a while, and they find a cellar. And they think, you know, they're hopeful. Maybe there's something stored in the cellar, right? Because that's what you do with cellars, old cellars. You would can your food and store your food down there. And they open the cellar and they go down in, and what they discover is that there are human beings essentially stored in this cellar, and that the human beings themselves have become food. They are what the others who live in this house, who aren't there at the moment, they are what they live on. And so it's just a reversal. It's a complete upending of the principle of hospitality, of welcoming someone into your house and giving them sustenance, when instead you're essentially assaulting them, bringing them into your house, and you're making them the source of your own sustenance. But if we live by this, eventually we're going to, you know, the idea is we're going to run out of anything and everything, right? Because we just consume and destroy. So can you be hospitable in the world that the road pictures? And then the question comes back, like, can you be hospitable in the world that we actually live in? Like, by which I mean, like, is there an infinite and abundant principle of life that allows us to share and make space for others, or isn't there? And it's not clear in this world, because on a physical level, there is barely enough for them to survive. And so at the end, what they find, and this is what brings conscience and hospitality together, at the end, what they find is a family, a man and his wife and two children, who have a little more than this boy and his father, and who take him in, this grand act of hospitality, to share what little they have when the boy's father dies. So there is hope, right? He's going to survive. And if he survives, the light survives. And if they are carriers of the fire, as they say they are too, then the fire is nurtured, and human love and human community and human goodness. And if that is an indication of the divine, then faith in God, all of that remains. But the ambiguity is also their resources are very limited, and they're also in danger of being captured by these marauding bands. And so the novel ends on that theme of hope, but once again, an ambiguous theme. Is there really enough in this world to sustain us all?
I think our listeners might wonder, well, why do we cover literary apologetics, and like, how relevant is that to us today? And I want to suggest a couple of things. One is, there's just so much in a lot of the novels that we've discussed, whether it's been Solzhenitsyn's work or Dostoevsky or Hemingway, we've talked about, and today Cormac McCarthy, that it really is great, not just reading for Christians to understand other worldviews and how to answer those biblically with scriptural truth and from a Christian worldview, but also, you know, you really could do it as a form of outreach. I mean, there's a lot of people who probably, you know, if they're not Christians, they're not involved in the church, it's not like they go gather sometimes with friends over talking about these kinds of concepts. So it's a great way to start something in your neighborhood and get to know some of your neighbors. I think a lot of us don't really know our neighbors. We just drive into our, you know, garages and close the door, and that's it. So that's a great way to get out there. And then also just the idea of being able to have sound answers from a Christian point of view that does give someone hope. So in ending this discussion, how does this particular novel, how does The Road help Christians not just navigate kind of different worldviews, but what would be beneficial to them to engage with this material?
Well, I think what I take most as a Christian reader away from this book is this sense that we live in contentious times. Like, humans have always lived in contentious times. That's not new, but at least right now, if we just take even just the United States, we live in very, very contentious times, where people who disagree with each other are having increasing difficulty in talking to each other and in seeing one another as in any way morally worthy. And when that sort of talking breaks down, as we're starting to see as well, violence tends to break out. And one thing that the road can remind us of, I think, is that when we finally see the other person as just an evil competitor to be destroyed, we create a situation in which we're likely to wreak havoc on the world. And hospitality, that theme, is kind of the answer to that, because hospitality is an openness to the other, to the stranger, a willingness to hear and listen and to consider people who are different from us, people who might even scare us a little bit, to listen to what they have to say and to welcome them in their humanity into our homes, into our lives, into our worldview, into our conversations. So what I guess I would want to say most about it is that this welcoming of the stranger, this hospitality, is intellectual, it's spiritual, it's physical, and the alternative is fighting. The alternative seems to be violence. And if we're going to tell people that God loves them, then our behavior toward them needs to manifest that. As John put it in, I think, the first John, you know, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He that loves not knows not God. The road is a clear and unsentimental picture of a world that said no to love, real love. And the result of that was a denial of the value of human life, the value of human beings, and a terrible evil that followed on that. I don't wish to be sort of ridiculously pessimistic and say we're on the verge of a nuclear holocaust in this world. I'm not suggesting that. But if we want people to believe that our God is a God of love, then we have to be intellectually and spiritually and literal ways, neighborly, hospitable to other people. And to me, that's what the road says most. If love and hospitality are going to triumph over hate and violence, they can only do so if we are committed to practicing these things, you know. And as Christians in a contentious world, we need to be careful and remember that we can get caught up in the same contentiousness. I don't mean not contending for the truth in the sense of speaking for it, but in this kind of argumentativeness that shuts off emotionally to the other, to the person who disagrees with us, and seeks to attain what you want by power and violence rather than by persuasion and conversation and, you know, hospitable and genuine love. And so I think that's what the road offers specifically to Christians, is a reminder of the inextricable bond between Christian faith and the declaration that God is love and that he has redeemed us and the practice of hospitality.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I want to end this podcast with some fun rapid-fire questions for Stephen. So, Stephen, do you like ice in your water or no ice?
No ice.
Do you know how to change a tire?
I do, yes.
What would you do on your ideal vacation?
I would go to a cabin in the mountains with my family. I would take long hikes. I would come back, read good books, and cook good food.
And 19th century literature or 21st century literature?
19th, for sure.
Well, thanks, Stephen, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. Stephen Mitchell, and we've been having a discussion about the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel from Cormac McCarthy called The Road. And you can read his review of this book completely free online at our website, equip.org. In addition, I just want to invite you again to do one of two things in order to help keep this podcast free, and that is If you're not already a Prince subscriber to our quarterly magazine, the Christian Research Journal, I invite you to subscribe to our magazine. A subscription is $33.50, or if a subscription is just not in your budget this month, I invite you to give us a tip of $3, $5, $10 or more, and you can do that at the landing page of this episode and really at the link that you will find at Stephen's review. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraph, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.